Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve sits down with Stephanie Forbes, CEO of the Forbes Group. Stephanie is a supply chain expert who recently released Global Wealth, Local Impact: How Supply Chains Build Thriving Companies, Cultures, and Countries, a book about building supply chains using lessons from our past. She and Steve discuss what she learned in her research for the book and supply chain management principles leaders can rely on in these unsteady times. Stephanie also gives advice for small and medium-sized businesses, how to manage supply chain issues across departments, and digital risk management.
In the world of cybersecurity, we're obsessed with the data. But as anyone knows, the lifeblood of the enterprise isn't just data, it's also the supply chain. And my guest today is Stephanie Forbes, who knows a thing or two about supply chains. Her expertise spans transforming teams, driving projects, delivering results for complex initiatives in the energy sector and beyond. She's also pretty good at providing strategic guidance on governance, risk management, and regulatory compliance. And she's passionate about elevating the supply chain profession, creating meaningful value for organizations and their communities. At a time when supply chain disruptions are at an all-time high, it seemed particularly timely to be having this kind of conversation. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you've written a book. It's not out yet. It's out in May. It's called Global Wealth, Local Impact: How Supply Chains Build Thriving Companies, Cultures, and Countries. And I was really intrigued by this because you've taken a quite interesting approach, I think. You look back in history to try to help make sense of the future. So tell us, what were the takeaways from that historical research?
So the thing I found particularly fascinating is historical repetition. We really like to do the same thing over and over again. And so some of those things we, you know, can see today are the markets, right? So when we think about currency manipulation, so the Romans at a time debased their own currency because they were in a trade deficit. They imported way more than they exported. So we see those kinds of things again. Currency manipulation is one. If there's a lot of money bandying about, we see people do silly things. So with the East India Company, we see people taking money for themselves. You know, it was a massive organization, unbelievably wealthy for its time. And so you had a lot of people stealing. But there is good things in there too, right? So the other piece that we see is innovation. We are master innovators historically, and we love to innovate. If there's a roadblock or a problem, we'll figure it out. If they're on the Silk Road, as an example, if something was blocked, we'd figure out another path or figure out some sort of solution to keep things moving. So that's what I thought was particularly fascinating. And just on a humorous side of things, the other thing I thought was actually pretty interesting was the outfits. Like everyone was obsessed with outfits, you know, everything from like powdered wigs to silk garments to just different pieces of prestige in terms of what people wore. And so that hasn't changed. We still are really obsessed with what we're wearing and why.
Fantastic. You would have think we would have got the hang of it by now then, wouldn't you? If we could learn from our past mistakes. But I suppose that's part of the challenge, right?
It is part of the challenge because a couple of things. We all don't necessarily value history as much as perhaps I do. Like, I really think history is fascinating and interesting, and that's not for everybody. And so there's some great lessons in there, but you may or may not even know about them because that might not be part of the things that you like to read or look up. But there's a lot of learning that can be done historically speaking. And as we kind of are in this huge space of disruption and chaos and everything else like that, there are some fabulous pieces in there in terms of every time chaos sort of reigns over the world, you have some basic principles that apply. And it's everything's going to cost more and you better bring the right kind of cash because it changes how we interact. When the risk profile goes up, we move into more of a protectionist model. We've seen that currently today. So it's interesting to see how different countries and different groups are navigating themselves, you know, where they're moving into a protectionist behavior type or they're moving into like a redundancy and resilience type of behavior. And so you see a cleaving off.
We've touched on it already, but geopolitically, of course, things are very unstable right now and have been for some time, sadly. What are some of the core principles that a business can apply to supply chain management that they can really rely on at this sort of very unsettled time?
If I just take a governance approach to it, one of the things that I've been very successful with in terms of a best-in-class governance program is a really consistent review. And that review looks like, what are my gaps? Where do I have gaps in my space? What can I audit? What can I bring in a third-party auditor on? So I'm going to just pick on tariffs as an example. Mm-hmm. Because of the chaos globally, doesn't matter which country you're in, the mechanism for collecting tariffs, assigning the appropriate HS codes, all that good stuff is all over the space. So bringing in a third-party auditor to look at your tariffs, so whether you paid the right amount, if you're owed something from the government, some of the tariffs have been reversed in different jurisdictions. And so like just getting that money back is going to be really important. So some sort of audit protocol would be in there. Mm-hmm. Then I always look internally. So what could we do better? So what are our internal systems and processes? And can we optimize those? Can we remove some redundancy that's not beneficial? Remove some red tape. And then what are we negotiating on? What are we not negotiating on? And where do we need to have better terms? And so when we look at this, we often think of we need to grind the supplier. We need to grind it by 10%. The cost might not be your problem. Your problem might be availability. Your problem mm-hmm. might be quality. You might have a different problem than cost. And so it's important when you're negotiating that you look at all the different things that are very important to you. It doesn't matter what you're charged. If you can't get the thing, you have nothing to sell. So I really want to sort of preface that negotiation piece. It's oftentimes, especially in today's climate, around access, around preferential treatment when you need something urgently, and around some of the governance pieces like paperwork. So if I need paperwork from you from a rare critical earth mineral piece of paper that I need that says that you've done all these things ethically, I might need to get that from you on a regular basis. And so that might be my number one important thing, because without that paperwork, I can't sell my product. And then lastly would be around compliance. So when we talk about suppliers, most organizations have many suppliers, right? They don't just have one or two. They don't produce everything themselves. They get their raw materials or raw inputs from somewhere else. And that supplier compliance piece around, are they behaving ethically and appropriately? Are they doing the things they say they're going to do? Do they produce the right paperwork I need for my imports or my exports? That compliance piece becomes really critical. And it's more than just a checkbox. Like, you're not just checking the boxes, you're really making sure and validating. You know, when I used to do this, we'd actually look up on Google Maps to see if there's a physical facility at that address, because we would get fake addresses mm-hmm. for some suppliers yeah. in different jurisdictions and like all different kinds of things. Really getting down into the weeds around your supplier compliance. So those would be like my five things in that governance space. I think any organization could pull on one or two of those little levers and have some good results.
Yeah, it's so important. I mean, it sounds very simple, doesn't it? You know, just make sure that the supplier is there. I remember some years ago now going off and doing a supplier audit and turning up in this particular town to find that the supplier actually didn't exist. There was mm-hmm. no facility. It's not as uncommon as people might think. I'm interested though, Stephanie, because, you know, we're talking about very large scale organizations. Does your advice change at all depending on the size of the organization or perhaps the location or some of the product offerings that they might be picking?
If you're a really small or even a medium-sized business, some of these things might be too heavy for what you're doing. So as an example, if I'm only a couple people, 10 people, you know, I'm probably not going to bring in a full-scale audit unless I'm importing a lot of goods, unless I have a really big tariff bill. And then it's probably worth it for me to take a look at that. So you're going to want to cherry pick the things that are really important. You're always going to want to look at your negotiation levers and say, where can I get better terms on certain things? And then you're always going to want to make sure that you have compliant suppliers, because that is a huge risk piece. So if you end up dealing with fraudulent suppliers who sell you something that isn't real, or they defraud you, whether that's through improper invoicing or they just produce things for you that are completely outside of spec, then you've paid for them and then you can't use them. Those would be the two negotiation supplier compliance would be the two big pieces that I would look at for really any organization. Even if you're just doing your own thing and you're a single person enterprise, negotiating better terms and then making sure your suppliers, who are they say they are, that's really an excellent 1-2 step. And then as you get larger, you can take a look at your actual systems and then take a look at your audit pieces. Gaps would also be something that I would look at. It's really hard to view your own gaps, though. Generally speaking, you need a bit bigger of an organization to look at some of your gaps. So I would say you probably need to be over about 10 people before you really can get some solid gap analysis. And then also you have to get buy-in. When you have really small groups, they we've always done it this way. I like how we do it. Why would we change now? Those types of things.
People element. I mean, you know, we talk so much about governance as being a process thing. Actually, it isn't. This is a lot of people stuff in there.
So it's actually people, processes, and systems. So it's a three-pillar approach, and each of them are equally important. I would actually say that your people are your number one always, because without your people, most of these things don't work. Even if we have all the most advanced AI systems in the world, they're still just a tool. You still need that critical thinking. You still need that human guidance and oversight and ideation to help move things forward, or depending on where you're going as an organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other things that I've noticed is that supply chains are only growing more complex. I'm curious, is there a point at which you think they'll become too complex?
So I think what's happening right now is we're at a critical point of where we didn't understand how globalization of our supply chains really worked. We didn't quite understand the, 17 different tiers to make a t-shirt. Like, we didn't understand all the different spaces and places in order to get something, or how many countries it involves. We're getting a lot better at that now. There's a large number of organizations that help you map your third, fourth, fifth tier suppliers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to become the standard. It's going to become very difficult, I think, in another 5-10 years to buy anything that doesn't have a full life cycle knowledge, awareness, or paper trail. Right. And that's going to be all the way down to the ink or the physical or all that kind of stuff. And so I think we're at a crucial inflection point. I also think they're actually going to become a little bit simpler, because we're seeing a lot of nearshoring that's occurring as a result of the geopolitical chaos that's occurring. And what's going to happen there is you're going to see groups of nations decide that they want to play with each other specifically. And so you're going to end up moving a lot of manufacturing locations to be closer. They're going to move critical infrastructure and critical manufacturing in country, like certain pharmaceuticals. Those types of things are going to end up becoming a little bit more local, as opposed to you can only get them in two places in the world, which is our current state right now for a lot of critical infrastructure items. So when you look at critical drugs, when you look at critical steel manufacturing and forming for construction projects, when you look at a large majority of things that we need regularly, they are sourced from very few countries globally. And I do think that is going to be a definite switch. And I think the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see the movement of those types of infrastructure projects coming in country. So whether that's North American, Mexico, Canada, Central America, or Latin America, South America, I think you'll see it move there. I think there's going to be certain production changes in Europe. I don't know which countries in Europe are going to be the ones that get the lion's share of manufacturing, but I think it'll be very dependent on what they're after. I think Germany is going to continue to be a big player, especially in the pharmaceutical space. I think there's a lot of things to watch and out for, and things to take a look at. And when we take a look at some of the remapping of the global positioning, and that's just not geopolitical, that's how all of our economies are going to flow commerce. And that is in a huge inflection point.
No, it is. You're absolutely right. And I know when I talk to ISF members, one of the challenges that they keep talking to me about is how do they manage the supply chain during that period of, didn't used to be upheaval, it probably is now, but just general movement. Mm-hmm. Because particularly if you're trying to get the security part of the business talking to the procurement, who typically tend to own supply chain, but not always, then very often there are different objectives, different goals those two parts of the business have. Any sort of advice for people on how we can bring that together, how we can break down those silos?
That's a really, really good question, Steve. So that is a question that I have navigated with my whole career, because oftentimes they're like, that's not operations, that's procurement, or that's somebody else's job. And really the supply chain and how that starts from like the beginning, we think we're going to do this thing, all the way to end of life, that whole process needs to be quite holistic. And that is, the earlier you can involve your sourcing teams with, whether it's your marketing team or your operations teams at the beginning, all the way through, you generally end up with way better outcomes. And that's indicative of any time you use collaboration across a whole organization in your functional areas, as well as your operational ones, is you have better ideas, you have better solutions, you're able to navigate quicker when problems do arise. And working with organizations to adopt a more holistic approach in terms of moving through the process together is really advantageous. We do this well in manufacturing. So this has all been pioneered. And I think everyone's read every case study that came out of Toyota in terms of all the wonderful work that they've done there. But the more that you can get groups to work together, the way better it goes. You see it also too on major projects teams, where the major projects teams will all work in groups of five or six, right? So you'll have whoever the procurement person is on the, say, for mechanical equipment, will work with the project manager and their discipline teams who will work with the engineers. And you have a group of five or six that all work on whatever that problem is together to get the project built and moving forward. And those are really good examples of high functioning teams, right? They function in high pressure environments where the risk is really high, where time matters, every second matters. There's huge sometimes liquidated damages for things being late. So they just can't be. So you see really, really great collaboration in those crucibles of risk and pressure. And it really produces, I think, some excellent results in terms of what you end up on the back end 9 times out of 10. We do have some issues with some of the major projects going way over budget and way over on time. And that's indicative of the different types of contracts that are being signed. Lately, there's a lot of contracts that don't have the same kind of schedule implications that they had even 10 years ago. I think that's a big miss. But when it comes to your question around that operational synergies and integrations, the more as a leader in your organization that you can really encourage and foster that cross-functional collaboration between your operations and your, whether it's procurement, supply chain, even finance, to really make sure everyone's talking the same language, it becomes a huge competitive advantage, especially when things are changing so rapidly, because the thing that you thought you needed yesterday isn't available, and now you've got to switch gears, and maybe it's a regulatory item, or maybe it has certain paperwork that you need to get, and now you need everyone to switch to a new gear to move faster so you can fulfill your orders from your clients. And it really becomes an interesting dynamic in terms of how quickly you can move, what types of problems you can solve when you work together as a holistic model.
Who should be pulling all of that together, Stephanie? Whose job is it?
That's a really good question as well. You need a leader to set the tone. You know, if you're a CEO, you need to set the tone around collaboration and cooperation. And then the expectation is for your groups to work together. You will 100% see this in the implementation of an ERP, where you have IT guy, his KPIs for this year are to implement an ERP, but the ERP doesn't exist on the ops team and that ERP implementation fails. So the easiest way for a CEO to do it is to say, okay, we have collaboration across your departments as a metric, and this is how we're going to measure it. And these are the things that we're going to do in terms of calculating how that works. And if it is on their annual performance reviews and bonuses, everyone suddenly collaborates. It's amazing how that works, but it does need to start at the top. And then you need to empower your leaders to say, get your teams collaborating. You get out there and collaborate and demonstrating that behavior. I've seen it so far where you should have the CEO of an organization sit down on a weekly operations call just to make sure everyone understands that they need to stay on track and they need to work together, walking that talk. And I've seen that be very successful. The more geopolitical instability we have, the more we're going to require that messaging to say collaboration, cooperation is key organizationally for us to survive. Because that inherently builds up that redundancy and resiliency pieces, because you're sharing a hugely risky load across the whole organization to come up with ideas and to innovate. We don't innovate very well in silos. We innovate very well in teams, high-performing teams.
And of course, all of this is moving and using much more digital tools. I'm curious, what should the next generation of supply chain leaders be learning about digital risk management today, do you think?
That's a good one. So there's many parts to that digital risk management. One is, what is the data that actually means something? You have a large organizations that are like, oh, we have 75 terabytes of data. It's all old data. If it's from 5 years ago, it's sure archive it, but it's probably not super helpful because the world is changing so fast. Anything that's older than 18 months probably doesn't have a ton of usefulness to it because people, organizations may not exist anymore. Stuff might not be available. Maybe you have a jurisdictional restriction. What is your good data first? And then the second piece is, how are we making sure that our data is being effectively managed and governed? And we have a bunch of regulatory pieces that are coming in to try and protect some consumer data, which is all great. But it's more than that. It's how do we protect our organization from not going under because we forgot to put in an encryption or because somebody gave out the keychain password for our Azure cloud because they didn't do a third-party authentication on the phone because they said they were an important person. So you have all of these sort of nuanced layers. And in the cybersecurity space, what I've seen in terms of breaches, oftentimes it is a tech support person trying to provide help to somebody who isn't who they say they are, and then they give out or they reset or they do something. So there's a lot of people errors that are still occurring and causing major breach types. And that for me is really interesting because we're trying to put all these layers in place, but still the largest risk organizationally from a cyber perspective and data perspective is people doing things they're not supposed to do, even though it might be well-intentioned. They're not doing things that they're supposed to do. So, you know, how do you protect for that from a cyber perspective? And then depending on the type of organization you are, really making sure that you've brought in a third party, I'll call it perspective, to make sure that you actually are doing everything that you need to do to protect your organization. Because the cyber incidents and events are becoming more sophisticated and it's easier for them to get to more people. I did hear a scary, and maybe you can help me with this one. I did hear a scary thing that one of the new AI bots was looking at if they could detect hacking. And then the bot started hacking itself. And so then they were like, oh, this probably shouldn't be happening. And so with the advent of the different types of AI, being able to go in and manipulate code and being able to hack our devices because it thinks it should, that also poses another threat. How do we protect against these AI bots either being used just incorrectly or being used nefariously? And how do we establish rules for that? How do we stop it? And sure, we can introduce laws and legislation, but we actually physically have to figure out how to stop that from happening aside from unplugging our laptops. So it becomes an ongoing risk profile evolution. And I really think ultimately the cyber piece around constant monitoring and risk analysis needs to be embedded into that daily operations. And you introduce a lot of that cyber risk every time you transact, and you transact the most through your supply chain space. Those are your POs, your invoices, your drawings or other materials, regulatory documents. And that's where I think you introduce a lot of potential risk.
It's a very valuable piece of the pie. That's the reason. You just talked about the financial element of it there. There's money in it, so therefore people are interested. You talked about blueprints. That's intellectual property. There's money involved in that. I think people quite often forget when we talk about supply chain that it brings together all of these different components that actually the cyber thief is very interested in getting their hands on. Interesting as well to hear what you say there about AI. I've probably moved now to a position where I'm increasingly frustrated and becoming a bit of a grumpy old man when I keep hearing all the time about people not thinking through some of these AI pieces. And it's almost as if I think we've got some organizations, not all, but some organizations who are almost sitting there looking very starstruck by this whole AI thing and how wonderful it's going to be. And they forget to put in place the right level of governance. We've talked a lot about that, but AI requires governance as well. The majority of companies still using AI today have not got in place the right level of governance. They have not trained their people. They do not have the right levels of oversight. And so we shouldn't be surprised, therefore, when things go wrong. And as I say, it's becoming a little bit of a mantra for me now because boards just don't seem to really be understanding and listening. And it won't end well, is the point I would make there. Talking about the board, one final question for you before I let you go. If you could leave a board with one particular sort of golden rule, if you like, for securing their supply chain over the next few years, what would it be to ensure they actually remain resilient in this sort of world in which we're living today?
That's a good question. Again, so one of the things that I really think about at the board level is oftentimes we move through the board level and we look at the finance piece, we look at the HR piece, we move through the things that we're required to do. But we don't really get down into the details because we always want to operate at a board level, at a 50,000 sort of foot view. Yeah. And occasionally you have to go, how is all this working? Is it working well? Do we have the right level of oversight into all of these activities? And occasionally it's important to have a deep dive done to say, are we doing this well? Especially if, and a lot of organizations don't have a chief procurement officer, right? They'll have two or three supply chain people that report into finance, maybe. Sometimes they report into operations. And so you don't necessarily have that level of oversight from a leadership level. And you don't necessarily have to, but as a board, you have to ask the question, hey, do we have any rare or critical earth minerals in our product? Do we record that? Do we track that? Do we have any tariff issues that we need to be aware of or go get audited on? We just paid X number of dollars, $1 million in tariffs. Are we sure we did that the right way? Have we checked with the broker? Have we checked here? Have we checked there? Do we have second and third suppliers for our critical products? Or are we just relying on the one that we've always had and we just hope that they continue to deliver? There's a few questions that, as a board, that you can really ask. And it doesn't, it's not super hard, but you know, like, where do we get our stuff from? Do we have a backup plan? What did the suppliers actually look like? Has anyone visited the supplier, to your point earlier that you made, and they, whether they exist or don't exist? The supply chain process is still one of the riskiest areas for fraud. $4.2 trillion a year is lost through supply chain fraud globally, annually. So it is a really likely place for fraud activities to occur. And it's not necessarily that your people are doing anything particularly wrong, but if someone can figure out how to invoice you and get paid, they will. Yeah, and it's really important that boards take that seriously. And they take that level of detail needs to become important. And you need to occasionally come down from 50,000 feet and go, what am I missing here? Because if you don't build up some level of redundancy and resiliency within that space, you're one or two disruptions away from whether or not you're going to stay viable as a business, because it is really volatile. It's unbelievable how much people take that for granted until something doesn't arrive, and then you have panic. The easiest thing as a board to do is ask three questions. First question would be, if our number one supplier stopped delivering tomorrow, how long would it take to replace them? And what would that process be? And if you don't have a reasonably good answer fairly quickly, that would be your number one problem. Second problem would be, are we missing any key documents for our top three suppliers? And that would be anything around critical or rare earth minerals. That would be anything around modern slavery reporting, that kind of stuff. And then lastly would be, is there a regulatory or geopolitical concern that I should have around this particular supplier? So as an example, if you are ordering something from China and you're in the US or you're in the other side of the ocean, in Canada, Mexico, anywhere else, what is the likelihood of that boat being disrupted if it has to come on a boat? Yeah. Can I get it on a plane? Do I really want to put it on a plane? And so you've got to ask yourself those questions and just even start with your top three suppliers and see what those answers are from your organization. But it's not super complicated. It's pretty straightforward. And it's always interesting, depending on what kind of answer you get, you know, pretty quickly, whether you need to do some more work.
Fantastic. Stephanie, look, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Some wonderful insights there. I love the examples and the questions that you've left our listeners with so they can go back and actually do something positive around this whole supply chain issue as soon as they finish listening. So thank you very much indeed. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISEF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.